or effects of adrenaline, but I could taste fear in the back of my throat and feel its despairing weight in my slack limbs. For some, I am told, this weighted-down helplessness comes in dreams. For me, it is my life. In my life as Ada, I must come to my own terms with the predator. I stopped, slowly turned, looked back. The movement behind me also stopped, a final swish in the tall grass by the path like the swinging of a velvet curtain dropped. Each time I paused, this happened. Then I would wait in the still and growing darkness till I could not wait any more and had to walk on. This is what it means to be very slow. Every story you would like to tell has already ended before you can open your mouth. When I reached our house, it was nighttime in another life. Sunset at 6 o'clock means that life does go on after dark, reading by lamplight on the porch, our family's evening event. Leah had come home with the buckets of water. Mother had boiled it and set it out to cool while she worked on dinner. Rachel had dipped a cloth in it to drape across her forehead while she lay in the hammock examining her pores with the hand mirror. Ruth May had attempted to convince every family member in turn that she could lift a full water bucket by herself with her one remaining unbroken arm. I know all this without having been there. Somewhere in this subdued family den, I was presumed to have been minding my own business for many hours. When I finally did return home, it was as if, as usual, I had shown up late for my own life, and so I slipped into the hammock at the end of the porch and rested under the dark bougainvilleas. A short while later, Tata Ndu emerged out of darkness. He came up the steps to explain in his formal French that the tracks of a large lion, a solitary hunting male, had been spotted on the path from the river. Tata Ndu's eldest son had just come back from there and brought this report. He had seen the marks of the little girl who drags her right foot, and the lion tracks, very fresh, covering over her footprints. He found the signs of stalking, the sign of a pounce, and a smear of fresh blood trailing into the bush. And that is how they knew the little crooked white child, the little girl without kakakaka, had been eaten. La petite blanche tordue a été mangée. This was Tata Ndu's sad news. Yet he looked pleased. As a favor to my parents, a party of young men, including his sons, had gone in search of the body or what might be left of it. I found I could not breathe as I watched his face tell this story and the faces of the others as they received the news. My sisters could not comprehend Tata Ndu's word salad of French and Kikongo, so were merely spellbound by the presence of a celebrity on the porch. I was the last thing on their minds, even Leah's. Leah, who had left me to the lion's den in question. But my mother, yes. No, she understood. She had hurried out to the porch from the cooking hut and still carried a large wooden paddle in her hand, which dripped steaming water onto the floor. Part of her hair fell in a wave across her face. The rest of her seemed unalive, like a pale wax model of my mother, the woman who could not fight fire with fire, even to save her children. Such affliction I saw on her face, I briefly believed myself dead. I imagined the lion's eyes on me like the eyes of an evil man and felt my own flesh being eaten. I became nothing. Our father rose and said in a commanding voice, "Let us all pray to the Lord for mercy and understanding." Tata Ndu did not bow his head, but raised it, not happily, but proudly. Then I understood that he had won and my father had lost. Tata Ndu came here personally to tell us that the gods of his village did not take kindly to the minister of corruption. As a small sign of their displeasure, they ate his daughter alive. It was very nearly impossible to make myself stand and come forward, but I did. Our father stopped praying for once. Tata Ndu drew back, narrowing his eyes. Perhaps it was not so much that he wanted me eaten, but that he did not like being wrong. He said no more than, "Mbote, fare thee well," then turned on his heel in a dignified way and left us to ourselves. He would not come back to our house again until much later, after many things had changed. The next morning we heard the search party had found what the lion killed in my place, a yearling bushbuck. I wonder about its size and tenderness, whether the lion was greatly disappointed, and whether the bushbuck loved its life. I wonder that religion can live or die on the strength of a faint, stirring breeze. The scent trail shifts, causing the predator to miss the pounce. One god draws in the breath of life and rises. Another god expires. Leah. Some people will send a bread and butter note after you have them over for dinner. Well, Anatole sent us a boy. He arrived at our door with a written note stating that his name was Likuyu, but we were kindly requested to call him Nelson. He was to be given his meals, the privilege of sleeping in our chicken house, where a handful of wary hens had crept back home after hiding from Mother's killing spree for the picnic, and a basket of eggs to sell each week so he could start saving up for a wife. In exchange, Nelson would chop our firewood, boil up steaming pots of lumpy manioc, and bring us fruit, greens, and bark potions collected from the forest. He concocted a headache cure that Mother came to rely on. He identified our snakes according to the categories of death they like to inflict, which he acted out for us in action-packed dramas on the front porch. He undertook other surprising tasks in our household, too, on his own incentive. For example, one day he constructed a bamboo frame to hold Rachel's hand mirror so we could hang it up on the living room wall for better viewing. Subsequently, Nelson began each day by standing with his face 3 inches from the framed mirror and laboriously combing his scant hair in our living room while smiling so broadly we feared his molars would pop out. Other people also began stepping into our house to avail themselves of our mirror in the same way. Evidently, what we had hanging up on our wall was Kalanga's only looking glass. As he peers at his reflection, I catch myself studying Nelson, his elbows darkened by use, his skin many tones of brown like antique mahogany furniture. Owing to his sugarcane habit, his stubby front teeth are all pretty much gone to the sweet hereafter. There's a disturbing monkey-like glint of canines off to the sides when he grins. But still, when he smiles, you know he really means it. He's cheerful and tidy and came to us with no possessions we could see other than an intact seat to his huge brown shorts, a red T-shirt he wears every day of his life, a leather belt, a pink plastic comb, a French grammar book, and a machete. Nelson travels light. He keeps his hair cut very close and has a perfectly round pink scar on the back of his neck. Anatole chose Nelson to help us because, like Anatole, he's an orphan. Some years ago, Nelson's entire family, including both parents, numerous older brothers, and a spanking newborn baby sister, drowned all together on a trip upriver when their boat overturned. The Congolese pirogues are made of a dense wood that sinks like pig iron when given half a chance. Since most Congolese can't swim, you'd think they would consider this a drawback to river travel, but evidently they don't. Merrily up the river and down they go without a thought to capsizing. Nelson was left behind that fateful day by accident, he claims. He says his mother was so excited about showing off the baby to the upstream relatives, he got jealous and hid out, and she plumb forgot to take him. Consequently, Nelson places great stock in signs and superstitions. And now he had found himself at loose ends, having no family of his own to help support, and being 12 years of age, finished with school. Anatole wrote in his note that here was his best student, and we would soon see why. We did. The day Nelson came to us, he only spoke, "How are you? Thank you, please," for English. But after a few weeks, he could say about anything that mattered without turning it all on its head the way Mama Tataba used to. I would say Nelson is gifted. But I'll tell you what, gifted doesn't count for a hill of beans in the Congo, where even somebody as smart as Nelson isn't allowed to go to college any more than us prize girls are. According to the Underdowns, the Belgians are bent on protecting against independent thought on native ground. If that is so, I wonder about Anatole, how the Underdowns got away with putting him in as a schoolteacher, for instance. I have scenes in my mind sometimes where I ask him, "When my sisters and I are lying down after lunch and my mind is idle, I think of these scenes. Anatole and I are walking on the path toward the river. There is some good reason we're doing this. Either he's going to help me carry something home, or maybe he invited me to discuss some point of the scripture he's not totally clear on. And so there we are, and we talk. In my imaginary scene, Father has forgiven Anatole and encourages his friendship with our family. Anatole has a very understanding smile with a slight gap between his perfect front teeth, and I imagine feeling so encouraged by that smile I even get up the nerve to ask him about his amazing face. How did they make every scar so perfectly straight? Did it hurt very much? And then he tells me about the rubber plantations. What were they like? I read in a book that they cut off the workers' hands if they hadn't collected enough rubber by the end of the day. The Belgian foreman would bring baskets full of brown hands back to the boss, piled up like a mess of fish. Could this be true of civilized white Christians? In my imagination, Anatole and I talk in English, though in real life he mostly speaks Kikongo to his schoolboys. His Kikongo accent is different from everyone else's. Even I can hear that. He pulls his mouth into broad, exact shapes around his teeth as if he's forever worried about being misunderstood. I think Anatole helps out our family because he's an outsider here, too, like us. He can sympathize with our predicament. and Father does seem grateful that he's still willing to translate the sermons even after the two of them had words. Anatole could be my father's friend if only he had a better grasp of the scripture. We were stumped as to why he was kind enough to send us Nelson, though. The first time Nelson fetched the water and boiled it by himself, Mother was so grateful she sat down in a chair and cried. A prize pupil is a very large gift. My theory is it was because of two things Anatole saw in our house. One, plenty of books for a smart boy to read, even if he can't go to school anymore. And two, we needed the help about as badly as the children of Moses needed Moses. Somewhere around Thanksgiving, Mother had begun praying out loud in front of my father for the Lord to please deliver us out of here all in one piece. He did not care for her displays of faltering faith and said so. It's true Ruth May gave us a bad scare, but he reminded Mother sensibly that a child can break an arm in Georgia or Kansas City or anywhere. And to tell the truth, if any of us was meant to do it, it was Ruth May. She tears through her life like she plans on living out the whole thing before she hits 20. And I hate to say it, but Ada is just as ornery and bent on destruction in her own slowpoke way. No one tells her to go off trailing through the jungle all alone. She could have stayed with me. The Lord is our shepherd, and the very least we sheep can do is keep up with the flock by our own devices, I should think. Especially since we are practically grown-ups now, to hear others tell it. You always see twins dolled up together as kids, but you never see two grown women running around in identical outfits holding hands. Are Ada and I expected to go on being twin sisters forever? Nevertheless, we both had to do the verse, Genesis 4, about Cain and Abel, after her so-called brush with the lion. And what with all that and the broken arm, Mother feared for our lives with fresh vigor. The rainy season had gotten heavier, and the whole village was coming down with the kaka-kaka. We thought this just meant hurry up. When Mama Mwanza told us all her children were getting it, we thought she meant they were getting restless or were finally scolded into doing their chores. But Nelson said, no, no, Mama Price, kaka, kaka. Evidently, it's a disease where you have to go to the bathroom 1,000 times a day. He acted it out in a pantomime that made Ruth May laugh fiercely. He said you go so many times you don't have anything left of your insides. Then the children will sometimes die. Well, Nelson says a lot of things. For example, if you run across two sticks in the shape of an X, you have to hop over it backwards on your left foot. So we didn't know whether to believe him about the disease. But then, next thing we knew, the little house right down the road from us turned up with a funeral arch made of braided palm fronds and flowers and sad, sad faces in the yard. It wasn't a baby dead, but the mother of them all, who were left looking just that much more skinny and forlorn, as if the wind got knocked out of the family when the mama went. You do have to wonder what she died of, and if it's catching. Well, that put Mother in a whole new frame of mind. Contagion, why, this was worse than snakes, since you couldn't see it coming. She dreamed up 101 excuses for keeping us inside the house, even when it wasn't raining. She invented rest time, a period of endless inactivity stretching out after school and lunch, in which we were ordered to stay in our beds under our mosquito net canopies. Mother called it siesta time, which at first I mistook as fiesta time, a puzzlement to me since it was not at all festive. Ruth May usually fell asleep, open-mouthed in the heat, with her hair plastered down across her sweaty face like the poster child for fever. The rest of us just sweated like swine as we sprawled side by side in our metal frame beds, separated by the ghostly walls of our mosquito nets, insulting each other out of a sense of general outrage and wishing we could get up. I had nothing to read but The Bobbsey Twins in Eskimo Land, a childish book with nothing whatsoever to hold my interest. I just envied those dumb Bobbseys for having a superior adventure to ours in that cool, snowy place where no one had to endure an enforced fiesta. I missed my freedom. There were so many things I needed to keep up with in the village, foremost among them, Eben Axelrod. He was up to something. The last time Ada and I spied down there, we heard the radio shrieking bloody murder, and for once we actually got to see him answer it. He rolled off his cot and muttered words I knew I could go to hell just for hearing. He knelt by the roaring footlocker and put a wire contraption against his head. He said, "Got it," many times over, and, "As good as dead if they do, sir." Oh, mercy, I had to tear myself away. And now I might never find out who or what was as good as dead, for it looked as if we were going to have to languish on our cots forever while the rain poured down. At least Rachel was useful for once in her life. In desperate straits, she can make us laugh, with her main talent being radio commercials oozed out in a fabulous fashion model voice. Medically tested Odo Rono stops underarm odor and moisture at the source. She'd toss her head then and throw her arms into the air, exposing her dark-stained underarms. She also did various hair products, swirling her white mane into a cow pie on top of her head, for today's new look of luxury. And she loved to remind us of Carnation Instant Non-Fat Dry Milk. New magic crystals dissolve instantly, which had become our mainstay food and did not dissolve instantly, but clotted up like white blood in our glasses. We were all so sick of those crystallized lumps, they choked us in our dreams. Sooner or later, she always ran out of commercials, though, like a toy winding down. Then all would go quiet, and we'd return cheerlessly to our books. Our reading material was random and inappropriate, delivered to us in unlabeled cardboard boxes from Leopoldville. We suspected Mr. Axelrod of having better boxes that he took to luckier children elsewhere. Back in Bethlehem, we ourselves had organized book drives for the underprivileged, and now I pitied those children who got slogged with our dusty second-rate novels and outmoded home carpentry manuals and were expected to be grateful about it. When we get back home, I vow I shall give all my very best books to the underprivileged, once I've read them. From the same nursery school lot that brought the Bobbsey twins, I chose a Nancy Drew out of pure boredom, feeling guilty and outraged to be reduced to that circumstance as a young woman who menstruates and reads at the college level. Though I must confess, some of the Nancy Drews held my attention. One of them had a strange secret basement plot that led me astray while I lay in bed trying to fall asleep into long fantasies that felt sinful. I think maybe it is true that the idle mind is the devil's workshop. I did have thoughts of the devil at these times. I imagined Nancy descending a long iron staircase into the netherworld and a man who waited for her at the bottom. Sometimes he was just a shadowy, faceless man in a hat. Sometimes he had a gap-toothed smile and an elegant, scarred face. Other times, he was that red devil who lurks on the Underwood ham cans, self-satisfied and corrupt in his bow tie, mustache, and arrowpoint tail. The first time I dreamed this scenario, I can't really say whether I was still awake or had fallen into a feverish, colorful sleep. All I know is that suddenly I snapped out of it, surrounded by the sharp odor of my own sweat, and felt prickled and exquisitely wide awake below the waist. I knew this feeling was very wrong. Even so, I had more such dreams, and sometimes I'm sure I was still half awake when they began. After a few weeks, my fevers became more pronounced, and my mother realized that because I am large and active for my age, she'd been underestimating my dosage of quinine. Those feelings below the waist, it turns out, were a side effect of malaria. For Christmas, Mother gave us all needlework things. We'd known not to expect much, and lest we forget, Father's Christmas morning sermon was all about having grace in your heart, which displaces the lust for material things. But still, for a Christmas tree, we had a palm frond stuck in a bucket of rocks. As we gathered around it and waited our turn to open our meager constructive gifts, I stared at that pitiful frond, decorated with white frangipani angels going brown around the edges, and decided the whole thing would have been better off ignored. Even when you've recently turned 15 without a birthday cake, it's hard to be that mature about Christmas. Mother announced that now we girls could use our idle time to build up our hope chests. I'd heard of this kind of thing before without giving it a second thought. I'd seen those Mark Eden advertisements in the backs of comic books which promised things embarrassing to look at, and so I assumed that building a hope chest was a question of exercising the muscles of the chest to get busts. But no, that wasn't it at all. Mother meant the other kind of chest, like a steamer trunk, in which a girl was supposed to put everything she hoped she'd get to use one day after she got married. This was her rationale for all the embroidery floss, pinking shears, and so on that we toted, secretly or otherwise, across the Atlantic. Now we were supposed to get enthusiastic about long-range marriage plans while lying here in bed watching our shoes mildew. Rachel and Ada were assigned any number of Hope Chest projects to work on, but the domestic arena was never my long suit, so I was to focus on a single big project, a cross-stitch tablecloth. It's nothing but 1,000 tiny X's to be made up in different colors of thread. The tablecloth has the pattern stamped straight on the linen in washable ink, like a paint-by-numbers picture. A monkey could do it if he got bored enough. Certainly no talent is required for cross-stitch. The hopeful part, I guess, is that after you're done with it all, you'll find someone who'd want to marry you. Personally, I can't see it as likely. In the first place, I am flat-chested, just plain too skinny. When Ada and I got moved up 2 grades, it just made things that much worse. We were preacher's daughters to begin with, and now we were really onions in the petunia patch, amongst all those 9th-grade girls with flirty eyes and foundation makeup and bosoms poking out the fronts of their mohair sweater sets. No boy ever looked at me except for homework help. And to tell the truth, I can't say that I care. Kissing looks like too much of somebody else's dental hygiene, if you ask me. If you want to see stars, which is what Rachel claims it's all about, then why not just go climb up a tree in the dark? When I try to picture the future, I can't see myself as anything but a missionary or a teacher or a farmer, telling others how the Lord helps those that help themselves. Some kind of life of piety, at any rate, which should guarantee that Ada's nowhere within 100 miles. And I should like to spend as much time as I can outdoors exulting in God's creation, and wear pants, if at all possible. I do sometimes picture myself with children, for why else am I keeping my notebook with all the lessons of my childhood in Africa? Yet you can't say boo to your own children without a husband first. It does seem a dreadful obstacle. My father says a girl who fails to marry is veering from God's plan. That's what he's got against college for Ada and me, besides the wasted expense. And I'm sure what he says is true. But without college, how will I learn anything of any account to teach others? And what red-blooded American boy will look twice at a geography whiz with scabs on her knees when he could have a sweater girl? I suppose I'll just have to wait and see. God must know his arithmetic. He'd plan it out well enough to plunk down a husband for every wife that he aims for to have one. If the Lord hasn't got a boyfriend lined up for me to marry, that's his business. Rachel, on the other hand, has never had any doubts in this department. Once she got over the initial shock of no new record album by the Platters, no mohair twin set, or any place to wear or dance to either one, she was thrilled by the notion of a hope chest, or pretended to be. Why, she'd throw herself belly down on her bed with her knees cocked and feet sticking up and her busy hands 5 inches in front of her eyes, plowing through her hope chest projects in earnest. She seemed to think she needed to have it all finished up in the next week or so. Oh, she monogrammed guest towels and crocheted collars for her trousseau and I don't know what all. It was the only time she ever stopped rolling her eyes and flicking her hair to settle down to a piece of honest work. Ada and I dragged our sewing projects out to the porch so we could still keep an eye out for interesting goings-on in the world. Something had come between Ada and me for the worse since the day she was supposed to have been followed by that lion, which the whole village was still talking about. They loved to point Ada out when they saw us, pantomiming a lion's roar, which didn't help us to put the affair behind us. But on the bright side, the event provided a great boost for Father's church. People seemed to think that if Jesus could stop a lion from gobbling up a poor lame girl, he must be staying awake pretty good for the Christians. Ha! Just when everybody was thinking their regular African gods were aggravated with us and fixing to teach us a lesson. The way they see it, it was kind of a wrestling match between the gods, with Jesus and Ada coming out on top. Father, of course, says this is superstitious and oversimplifying matters. But as luck would have it, he'd preached the parable of Daniel in the lion's den just a few days before, so naturally now they are knocking each other over to get to church on Sunday, and Ada is the cause. Father is pleased as punch with Ada. I don't care what he says. He put his arm around her shoulder in public, which is not entirely fair. But we still had to go on being each other's main company. Chained to the porch by Mother's instructions like grumpy twin bears in captivity, we enviously watched Nelson as he went about his business, free to go back and forth to the village and contract the kaka-kaka any time he had a mind to. As he walked away, we could see his round pink scar spying back at us through the trees like a small laughing eye. We also watched Methuselah, who after 4 months of liberation still hung around our house mumbling. It was very strange to hear the voices of our own family members coming from the tree branches, as if we'd been transformed into flying spirits of a type preoccupied with peanuts, bananas, and common phrases of greeting. Sometimes at night he'd startle us when we forgot he spent his lonely nights in the latrine. Believe me, it gives you a queer feeling to sit down in the dark to pee and hear a voice right behind you declare, "Sister, God is great!" But we felt sorry for him and took to leaving him pieces of fruit in there. We were careful to keep the latrine door shut and latched at night so no mongoose or civet cat would find its way in and polish him off. At first, I wanted Methuselah to come back and live in his cage until Father explained to me that this whole arrangement was wrong. We let Methuselah go because his captivity was an embarrassment to us. It made the parrot into a less noble creature than God intended. So I had to root for Methuselah to learn to be free. I don't know what Ada rooted for as we lay out there with our needlework, watching him waddle up and down the branches. I have to say she probably didn't care one way or the other, really, and was just fascinated to see what would happen next. Ada's that way. She feels no obligation to have good thoughts on behalf of her mortal soul in the hereafter, or even the here and now. She can simply watch life without caring. Certainly she wasn't putting in any effort on behalf of her future womanhood. Ada did weird, morbid things for her hope chest, black borders on cloth napkins and the like, which exhausted our mother. And Ruth May was exempt from hope chest, but was allowed to lie in a hammock with us and make the cat's cradles out of yarn if she promised not to run off and break something. I lolled on my back and worked on my tablecloth listlessly to preserve my mother's fantasy that I'd be getting married one day, and after a while it began to draw me in. The cross-stitch itself was tedious, but the prospects were beautiful. Mother had the foresight to give me a botanical motif, knowing how I love green and growing things. Bunches of pansies and roses were meant to bloom in the four corners, all connected by a border of twining green vines. And in the very same way the spirit long ago became manifest in the body of Christ, the first cabbage rose began to materialize on my tablecloth. From there, I could envision the whole garden. Still, the project seemed impossibly large. Rachel polished off a complete set of dinner napkins in the time it took me to fill in one pink rose. The humidity was so thick it dripped off our eyelashes, and in this damp atmosphere the first bouquet took so long that my metal embroidery hoops rusted in place. The Hope Chest program didn't last long as our main preoccupation. Rachel hoped too much and ran out of material, while the rest of us hoped too little and ran out of steam. Once in a great while, I still do pull out my tablecloth and try to get re-inspired. I've even prayed for God to make me more fit to be a wife. But the rusted embroidery hoops left an unsightly orange ring on the linen that may have damaged my prospects for good. Ruth May. I tried to see Nelson naked. I don't know why I wanted to. When he gets up in the morning, first he washes his face out of a dingered-up bowl in the chicken house and puts on his pants and his shirt. He washes the back of his neck with the pink hole in it till his skin shines and water runs all down. Then he looks at his clothes real hard and says a hex before he puts them on. Brown pants, red T-shirt, that's all the clothes he has. Everybody here has just one clothes. My friends are the one with the blue pajama shirt, the one with the checkered pants with the legs rolled up, the one with shorts with big white pockets hanging out the bottom, and the one with the pinkish shirt down to his knees and no pants. The girls don't ever, ever wear pants. And the little babies don't wear a speck of clothes, so they can just squat down and pee-pee ever when they take a mind to. The chicken house is made out of sticks. The wall has square little holes, and I just wanted to see Nelson. I was bad. Sometimes I prayed for baby Jesus to make me be good, but baby Jesus didn't. The chickens were setting on eggs, good little mamas, we said, making us some more chickens. Their house was nothing but a shack. They tried to hide their nests in the bushes, but Nelson and I found them. He said they were bad hens trying to steal their babies from us. I tried to scold them, but he said chickens don't understand English. He showed me how to sing to them. Kuyibadiyaki, kuyibadiyaki, mboteve, mboteve. Then we took back all those eggs. I got to help Nelson in the morning when Rachel and them had school if I promised Mama I wouldn't go near any other children. They're all sick. They have to go to the bathroom number 2 in the bushes, and we might catch it. We took the eggs into Mama, and she floated them in a bucket. Some sank on the bottom, and some floated on top like when you bob for apples. The sinkers are okay to eat, and the floaters are the rotten ones. When you say last one in is a rotten egg, I reckon that means you're going to float. Nelson wanted those, and Mama worried he'd get sick if he ate them, but she said, oh, go ahead. And so he took them, but he didn't eat them. He hid them in a place. He said the witch doctor, Tata Kuvadundu, wanted those eggs for the dead people that needed to lie down. Nganga means witch doctor. Tata Kuvadundu is one because he has 6 toes on one of his feet. Nelson said Nganga Kuvadundu could make live people dead and dead people come back alive. Nelson thinks Tata Kuvadundu is probably so important he could run the army, but he's too old. Maybe one of his sons instead. Nelson knows who Patrice Lumumba is, too, like me. He says some of them are saying to bury rocks in your garden right now, and after the white people are all dead, dig them up, and those rocks will be turned into gold. Nelson said he didn't believe that. Nobody really believes it, he said, except the people that want to. And I said, why will all the white people be dead? Nelson didn't know. There's all these extra people going to church now. Nelson says it's because the lion tried to eat up Ada, but Jesus turned her into a bush buck right just at the last minute, like in the Bible. And right when the lion's mouth bit down on the Ada that turned into a bush buck, the real Ada disappeared from there and turned up okay on our porch. Nelson says everybody's got their own little god here to protect them, special African ones that live in the little tiny thing they wear around their necks. A gree-gree is what you call it. It's like a little bottle only made out of sticks and shells and things. Sometimes I think about all those little teeny gods riding around on people's necks, a-hollering, help, let me out of here, like the genie in the Aladdin's lamp. You'd just rub it and say, here, little god, you better watch out for me or you'll get eat up by the lion right along with me. All the little gods are mad at Jesus right now, and they'd like to hurt one of us if they could, if Jesus doesn't look out. I told Nelson that Jesus is way too big to ride around in a little gree-gree. He's big as a man, with long brown hair and sandals, size extra large. Nelson says yes, everybody's figured out that he's the right good size. They've a lot of them started going to hear Father talk about Jesus and figure out what's what. But Nelson says they've got one foot in the door of the church and one foot out. If something bad happens to one of us, out they'll go. After we found all the eggs in the bushes and took them, baby Jesus made all the chickens be good and lay their eggs in the one big nest we made in the corner of the chicken house. Mama took a pencil and marked 13 eggs with X. We kept those in the nest, and when the hens laid fresh ones, we took those for eating. Sometimes scrambled, sometimes hard-boiled. We don't ever eat the X-mark eggs because they're going to turn into baby chickens. When they grow up, they'll be our new laying hens, some of them, and the other ones will grow up to be fried chicken. The not lucky ones. They'll get their necks chopped off and jump around squirting blood. Ha, 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 poor them. The chickens better get their own little gree-grees to wear around on their necks, I reckon. Every day I looked to see if the babies hatched out, and I was the first one to find them. They all hatched out but save for one, and it got squashed. It was flat against the mud wall behind the nest like a picture hanging up. Nelson lived in there with the dead baby chicken picture on the wall. I was sorry and didn't try to look at his peewee anymore after that. If it's dark outside and you see a snake, or even if you just want to talk about one, you can't say snake. You have to say string. You say, remember that day we saw a little black string coming home from the picnic? If it's nighttime, that's how you talk. Nelson got so mad at me for saying snake when it was dark because he says after the sun goes down, a snake can hear you calling its name and it'll come running. Other animals, too. They can hear real good in the dark, so watch out. Nelson got mad at Leah, too, for keeping her owl for a pet. The owl was a baby that couldn't fly right when we found it, so Leah made it a cage and fed it bugs and some meat. Its fur is white and sticks out all over. Leah named it a word in that language they have here, mvufu. It means owl. But Leah's friend Pascal hates it, and Nelson hates it worse. Mama Bwanza hates it when she comes over scooting on her hands to trade us oranges for eggs, and Mama Bwanda does. She's the one that wears the black skirt with the great big pink star across her bottom and a hairdo that looks like stars, too, sticking up every which ways. The one that does people's hairdos is old Mama Lowe, who's only got just the two teeth, one upstairs and one down, so she chews crossways. She hates our owl the most of all and hollered at us for having it, because her sister just died here a while back. Everybody that sees our owl just plumb hates it. Nelson said take it out of the house or he wasn't coming in, and that was that. Well, Mama made her take it outside even though Leah pitched a fit because it was still yet just a baby. That's true, it was. It was getting feathers, but mostly it still had white baby hair and was tame. Nelson went and got Anatole, pulling on him by the hand like he was a note from home. Anatole said the Congo people don't like owls because an owl flies around at night and eats up the souls of dead people. And there's just way too many of them here lately, he said. Too many sick children for people to abide an owl hanging around and looking at him with his eyes still hungry. Even if the owl was just a baby himself, maybe he'd want other babies for company. Father said that was all just superstitions. So, Leah went and fetched the owl back and sashayed around the house with it sitting on her shoulder, saying Father was sticking up for her side of things. Uh-oh. He smacked her hard for the sin of pride and made her do the verse. She sat there holding the side of her neck while she wrote it out. When she put her hand down, you could see the bruise just as plain. It looked like Father was holding his hand in front of the kerosene light and making a shadow on her, but he wasn't. He was in the other room or reading his Bible. When she got done with her verse, she went way down in the jungle to turn that baby owl loose, and we thought she never would come back. We were all scared half to death and sat up waiting for her, except Father. It was so quiet you could hear the second hand on Rachel's Timex going st-st-st. The flames in the lantern went up and down, and the shadows jiggled every time you'd go to blink your eyes. It was way after dark by then, so whatever you were thinking might have had a hold of Leah out there, snake or leopard. You just couldn't say anything out loud but string or spotted cloth. I said, I hope a string didn't bite her. Father already went in his bedroom way, way earlier. He hollered finally for Mama to put us to bed and come on herself. He said our sister would be back, so we'd just as well go on about our business because she was just looking for the attention. He said not to pay her any mind or we'd get the same medicine. Then he said, if an owl can eat up a soul outright, he is one step ahead of the devil, for the devil has to purchase them first, and I see he has made some purchases right here in my own household. Father was mad and wanted to get off the subject of Leah, since it was him that ran her off. We didn't say boo to him, nor go to bed either. We just sat there. Mama stared out the open doorway with all her might, waiting on Leah to get home. The mosquitoes and big white moths came in the door and went out the windows. Some of them decided to take off their coats and stay a while, so they flew in the kerosene lamp and got burned up. That's what happens to you if you're bad and don't go to heaven. You go and get burned up in the bad place instead. So that night, our house was the bad place for the Congolese bugs. Ha ha. Father is trying to teach everybody to love Jesus, but what with one thing and another around here, they don't. Some of them are scared of Jesus, and some aren't, but I don't think they love him. Even the ones that go to church, they still worship the false idols and get married to each other time and again. Father gets right put out about it. I'm scared of Jesus, too. When she came back from the woods, we hooped and hollered and ran to the porch and just jumped up and down and pulled her inside by her shirt tails. But uh-oh, there was Father in his dark bedroom doorway looking out. All you could see was his eyes. We didn't want to get the same medicine, so we just looked at Leah real hard with "I'm sorry for you" eyes and tried to get a nice message across. After we went to bed, I reached over through the mosquito net and held her hand. Mama didn't sleep in her room. Mama says birds are going to be her death. I'd sooner say it was snakes. But I guess if a bird's going to eat up the dead children's souls, that is a worry. That is one more sound to listen for at night. One more thing you can't say out loud after dark. Rachel. In January, the Underdowns showed up as a complete surprise from Leopoldville. They came in Mr. Axelroot's plane when the most we were really expecting was potato buds and Spam. The Underdowns don't like to come out here in the boondoggle, so believe you me, this was an occasion. They looked like they had nervous tension headaches. Mother was upset because they're our bosses from the Mission League and they'd caught her red-handed doing housework in her old black capri pants with the knees worn through. She was a sight to behold there on the floor scrubbing away with her flyaway hair sticking out and dark bruise-colored circles under her eyes from all her worrying about us catching the kamikaze disease. What with the mongooses and lizards traipsing in and out of the house as they pleased, she had a lot more to be embarrassed about than just getting caught in her old clothes, it seems to me. But at least that horrible owl was gone. Thank goodness to that, even if Father did come down too hard on Leah about it. That was a bad scene. We were all tiptoeing around on the eggshells even more than usual after that. But that owl stank of rotten meat, so I do have to say good riddance. But listen, why should we have to put on the Ritz for the Underdowns? They aren't even Baptist, I heard Father say. They just oversee the financial affairs for the Mission League since so many people have pulled out. They're Episcopotamians, and their real name is actually something foreign like Entre Don. We just say Underdown because it's easier. To tell you the truth, the two of them are just a couple of the plainest Janes you ever saw in their economical home haircuts and khaki trousers. The funny thing about Frank and Jana Underdown is that they look exactly alike except for the accessories. He has a mustache, she has little gold cross earrings and glasses on a chain, Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head. They sat at our table sweating while Mother ran and squeezed the orangeade and served it. Even the glasses were dripping with sweat. Outside, the sky was getting its regular afternoon storm organized, wind whacking the palm leaves together, red dust ghosts flying up from the road, little kids running like bandsheets for cover. Mother was too nervous to sit down with the company, so she stood behind Father's chair, leaning on the windowsill, waiting for him to finish the newspaper they'd brought. All of them passed it around, except Mr. Axelroot, the pilot, who probably wouldn't know what to do with the newspaper except wipe as you know what. Yes, he was there among our numbers, too. He stood leaning in the back doorway and spitting until I thought I would croak. He stared right at me, undressing me mentally. I have said already my parents are entirely in the dark about certain things. I made faces at him, and finally he went away. While Father was reading the latest news, Mrs. Underdown tried to make friends with Mother by complaining about her houseboy in Leopoldville. Honestly, Orleana, he would steal anything except the children, and would have those, too, if he thought he could sell them. If I try to lock things up, he slaps his hands over his heart as if I've accused him of murder, even though I just caught him the night before with four of Frank's handkerchiefs and a kilo of sugar tucked into the front of his shirt. He always claims he has no idea how they got there. "Well, my stars," Mother said, without seeming all that interested. Mrs. Underdown stared at Mother, puzzled. "Your stores?" She always implies we have an accent by repeating our words and expressions like little jokes. With her being somewhat of a foreigner herself, that's the pot calling the skillet black, if you ask me. For once, my sisters and I got excused from spending the whole livelong morning playing ding-dong schoolhouse with Mother. But we were curious about the Underdown visit and didn't really want to leave. We were so deprived of company, honestly. I lingered about the room checking my hairdo once or twice in the mirror and tidying up the desk, and finally ended up loitering out on the veranda with my sisters, close enough to the doorway so that we could keep tabs. We stared at the glasses of orangeade, wishing Mother had had the simple confederation to make enough for all of us, while we listened in and tried to get the picture of what had caused them to come out here. Even though I knew before it was over, I would probably go bored out of my gourd. Sure enough, when they'd finished passing around the newspaper article, they dropped the subject of the Underdown's criminal element, houseboy, and moved on to the subject of everything dull under the blue sky. New sheets, malaria pills, new Bibles for the school, that jazz. I sashayed in and picked up the newspaper after Father'd thrown it down on the floor. Well, why shouldn't I? It was written in red-blooded English from New York, the United States of America. I read the page they'd folded back. Soviet plan moves forward in Congo. It said Khrushchev wanted to take over the Belgian Congo and deprive the innocent savages of becoming a free society as part of his plan for world domination. Jeez Louise, if Khrushchev wants the Congo, he can have it, if you ask me. The newspaper was from last December anyway. If his big plan was going so well, seems like we would have seen hides nor tails of the Russians by now. The article told how the Belgians are the unsung heroes, and when they come into a village, they usually interrupt the cannibal natives in the middle of human sacrifice. Huh. If they came to our village that day, they would have interrupted Mother in the middle of scrubbing the floor and about 12 little naked boys having a pee-pee contest across the road. I gave the newspaper to Ada, and Leah read it over her shoulder. They turned some pages and showed me a cartoon. Big, fat, bald-headed Nikita Khrushchev in his communist uniform was holding hands and dancing with a skinny cannibal native with big lips and a bone in his hair. Khrushchev was singing, "Bingo, bango, bongo, I don't want to leave the Congo." I stared out the window wondering who wouldn't want to leave the Congo before you could say Jack Robinson if they had half a chance. The Underdowns and Mother were just finishing up with the fascinating subject of quinine pills, and then it went quiet for, as they say, an uncomfortable silence. The Underdowns went, ahem, and crossed their legs and got around to what appeared to be their big news. The Congo is going to have an election in May and declare their independence in June. As far as I'm concerned, you can chalk that one right up with malaria pills and Bibles for a tedious topic. But Mother and Father seemed to take it as a shock. Mother's whole face dropped out of its socket. She looked like Claire Bloom in Beauty and the Beast when she finally gets a look at what she's going to have to marry. I kept waiting for Mother to snap back to her old everything-is-just-fine attitude, but she stayed blanched out and kind of stopped breathing. She put her hand on her throat like she'd swallowed a shot of Mr. Clean, and that look scared me. I started paying attention. "This June," Mother said. "Belgium won't possibly accept the outcome of an election," Father said. Oh, well, naturally, he already knew all about it. No matter what happens on God's green earth, Father acts like it's a movie he's already seen, and we're just dumb for not knowing how it comes out. Leah, of course, was about to fall out of her hammock, hanging on his every word. Ever since Father smacked her over the owl, she's been trying twice as hard to win him back over. "Belgium absolutely will, Nathan. This is the new official plan. King Baudouin invited 80 Congolese leaders to Brussels to chart a course for independence." So said Mr. Potato Head, who has no elocution in his voice whatsoever. I am positive he is foreign, or used to be. "When?" Mother asked. "2 weeks ago." "And might we ask what happened to the old official plan?" Father said. He always has to say, "and might we ask," instead of just asking. Leopoldville and Stanleyville have been shut down with riots and strikes, in case you haven't heard. The old official plan did not go over so well. "What about the threat of a Soviet takeover?" Mother wanted to know. "Frankly, I think Belgium is more concerned about the threat of an African takeover," he said. Reverend Underdown, whose name is Frank, says "frankly" a lot, and he doesn't even see the humor. "The Russians are a theoretical threat, whereas the Congolese are quite actual and seem to mean business. We say in French, if your brother's going to steal your hen, save your honor and give it to him first." "So they would just hand over independence to the Congolese?" Mother leaned forward over Father's head to speak. She looked like Father's guardian angel with iron-poor, tired blood. "Frank, what leaders are you talking about getting invited to Brussels? Who on earth around here is eligible for a thing like that?" "Tribal chiefs, heads of unions, and the like. They say it was a pretty motley assembly." Joseph Kasavubu wavered between boycotting and trying to run the show. Lumumba got out of jail just for the occasion. They settled on a parliamentary system of government. Elections will be mid-May, Independence Day, June 30th. Methuselah had sidled up into the bougainvillea bush right behind us, muttering, "Lubber, lubber, lubber, lubber." I swear it was like he was trying to listen in on the conversation, too. "Belgium has never been willing to discuss independence before," Father declared. "That's true, Frank," Mother added. She had both hands on her hair, pulling it back from her face like a skinned rabbit and fanning her neck in the back. It wasn't at all becoming. "We discussed this with the mission people in Atlanta before we ever decided to come. They said the political advisors in Belgium had mapped out a plan last year that would grant independence in, what was it, Nathan, 30 years. 30 years' time. Mother had raised her voice a little, and Mr. Potato Head looked embarrassed. "I'm sorry to have to remind you that you were advised not to come," he finally said. "That's not exactly true," Mother said. She looked at Father, and Mrs. Potato Head looked at Father. Father stared at Mr. Potato Head, who didn't have the nerve to look him in the eye. The whole thing was out of this world. Finally, Mr. Potato Head dared to speak. "No offense intended," he said. "Your work here certainly has the blessings of the Mission League, Orleana." He may have meant no offense, but he pronounced my mother's name like a bad word. "And I would also say it has the admiration of many people who lack your family's boldness." He looked at the button on his sleeve, probably sewn on upside down or something by the handkerchief-stealing houseboy. Then he started turning his wet, empty glass around and around on its damp ring on the table. Everybody waited for what else Frank Underdown might have to say with no offense intended. Finally, he allowed, "But you do know your mission here was not sanctioned." He glanced up at Mother, then back to his spinny-go-round glass. "Well, whatever does that mean?" "I think you know. You didn't get the language in service or any of the ordinary kinds of training. I'm afraid the Mission League thinks of your stipend as an act of kindness on their part. I would not be too surprised to see the end of it now." Well, Mother's hand hit the table. Bang! "If you think my family is living in this moldy corner of hell for the $50 a month," she practically shouted at him. "Man, oh man, if the porch could have opened up and swallowed us all." "Orleana," Father said. Dog peed on the carpet voice. "Well, Nathan, for heaven's sake, can't you see you're being insulted?" Usually Father doesn't have to look twice to see when he's being insulted. Usually he can see insults as big as a speck when they're hidden under a rock in the next county over. We all crossed our fingers. "Now everyone simmer down," said Mr. Potato Head, trying for a fake friendly laugh. "Nobody's being insulted. We don't have any control over the decisions of the Mission League, you know that. We're just humble administrators for the SBML and a lot of other organizations who are all giving similar advice right now. We came here to talk with you personally because we are deeply concerned about your witness for Christ and your precious children." My mother, who had just said the word hell, was about a million miles from her witness for Christ at the present time. I would say at the present time she looked ready to bean somebody with a baseball bat. She turned her back on the Underdowns. "Why in the world did they let us come here if it was dangerous?" she asked some birdie outside the window. Father had not spoken up yet. My theory was he didn't know who to jump on first, the insulting Underdowns or his cussing wife, so he just stood there brewing like a coffee pot. Only with a coffee pot you know exactly what's going to come out of it. "Now please, Orleana," Mr. Potato Head crooned, "this is not the fault of the Mission League. No one could have predicted the move to independence would come so suddenly." She turned around and faced him. "Wasn't it somebody's darn business to predict it?" "How could they?" he asked, opening his hands wide. "Last year when de Gaulle gave independence to all the French colonies, the Belgians insisted this had nothing to do with us. No one even took the ferry across to Brazzaville to watch the ceremony. The Belgians went on speaking of rule with a fatherly hand." "A fatherly hand? Is that what you call it?" She shook her head from side to side. "Using these people like slaves in your rubber plantations and your mines and I don't know what all? We've heard what goes on, Frank. Do you think we're simple-minded? There's men right here in this village with tails to make your hair stand on end. One old fella got his hand whacked off up at Coquiatville and ran away while he was still spurting blood." Father shot her a look. "Well, honestly, Nathan, I talked to their wives." She looked at Mrs. Potato Head, who was keeping Mum on the subject. "We had no idea," Mother said quietly then, like she'd just figured the whole thing out. "Your King Baudouin is living off the fat of this land, is what he's doing, and leaving it up to penniless mission doctors and selfless men like my husband to take care of their every simple need. Is that how a father rules? Hell's bells, and he didn't expect trouble?" She glanced back and forth between Mr. Underdown and Father like a nervous child herself, unsure which of the two men was entitled to give her a licking. Mr. Underdown stared at Mother like he suddenly had no idea where she'd come from, like that houseboy that didn't know how the sugar got under his shirt. Man, oh man, that made me nervous. Every grown up in the room, including my mother, the cussing lady, and Mrs. Underdown, who kept rubbing her neck and craning her chin to the side, you could have mistaken for a mental psychiatry patient right then. Except for Father, and of course he is the one who is really mental. The Reverend Underdown flung out his fist, and Mother flinched, but he wasn't aiming for her at all. It turns out he just meant for them all to admire his hand. "That is the relation of Belgium to her Congo," he said. "Look there. A strong hand, tightly clenched. No one could have predicted an uprising like this." Mother walked straight out of the room, out the back door toward the kitchen. No one mentioned her absence. Then, in a minute, she came back, having just remembered, evidently, that she couldn't go hop on the Greyhound bus to Atlanta. "What's he really saying?" she asked Mrs. Underdown. "That there's going to be no transition at all, no interim period for, I don't know, a provisional government in training? Just wham, the Belgians are gone and the Congolese have to run everything on their own?" Nobody answered, and I was scared Mother would start swearing about the king again or crying. How embarrassing. But she didn't do either one. She pulled on her hair for a while and then tried out a new, improved, let's get this all straight voice. "Frank, Jenna, not a soul among these people has even gone to college or traveled abroad to study government. That's what Anatole tells us. And now you're saying they'll be left overnight to run every single school, every service, every government office, and the army? What about the army, Frank?" Reverend Underdown shook his head. "I can't tell you how, Orleana. I can only tell you what I know." "Home, home, home, home," I prayed. "If the problem was big enough, we'd just have to go home. We could get on that plane tomorrow and fly straight out of here, if only he would say so." Father got up and came to stand in the doorway facing out toward the porch. I shuddered, both hoping and dreading that he'd read my mind. But he wasn't looking at us girls. He just stared right past us to make a point of turning his back on the present company of Underdowns and Mother. I slouched back into my hammock and attended to my cuticles while Father spoke to the great outdoors. "Not a television set in this whole blessed country," he announced to the palm trees. "Radios, maybe 1 per 100,000 residents. No telephones, newspapers as scarce as hen's teeth, and a literacy rate made to match. They get their evening news by listening to their neighbors' drums." That was all true. Almost every single night we could hear those drums from the next village over, which Nelson said was talking drums. But what in tarnation could you tell somebody with just a drum? It would have to be worse than that dip-dip-dot-morse-scold thing they use in the army. Father said, "An election? Frank, I'm embarrassed for you. You're quaking in your boots over a fairy tale. Why, open your eyes, man. These people can't even read a simple slogan. Vote for me. Down with Shapoopy. An election? Who out here would even know it happened?" Nobody answered him. We girls never said a peep, of course, any more than the palm trees did, for we knew he was talking to Mother and the Underdowns. I knew just how they felt getting one of Father's pop quizzes. 200 different languages, he said, spoken inside the borders of a so-called country invented by Belgians in a parlor. You might as well put a fence around sheep, wolves, and chickens and tell them to behave like brethren. He turned around looking suddenly just like a preacher. "Frank, this is not a nation. It is the Tower of Babel, and it cannot hold an election. If these people are to be united at all, they will come together as God's lambs in their simple love for Christ. Nothing else will move them forward. Not politics, not a desire for freedom. They don't have the temperament or the intellect for such things. I know you're trying to tell us what you've heard, but believe me, Frank, I know what I see." Mrs. Potato Head spoke up for the first time since they drifted from the subject of malaria pills. "Orleana, all we really came here for is to tell you to make your plans to leave. I know you were going to stay on till the 15th of June, but we have to send you home." Boy, did my heart do the cha-cha hearing that. Home. Well, if there's one solitary thing Father does not like, it's being told what to do. "My contract expires in June," he announced to all concern. "We will stay through July to help welcome the Reverend and Mrs. Minor when they come. I'm sure Christian charity will be forthcoming from America regardless of any problems Belgium may have with its fatherly hand." "Nathan, the miners," Frank started to say, but Father ran him right over and kept going. "I've worked some miracles here, I don't mind telling you, and I've done it single-handedly. Outside help is of no concern to me. I can't risk losing precious ground by running away like a coward before we've made a proper transition." Transition when is what I wanted to know. Another week, a month, July was practically half a year away. "Frank, Jana," my mother said in a voice that sounded scared. "For my own part," she said and faltered. "For the girls, I'd like to..." "You'd like to what, Orleana?" Father was still right out there in the doorway so we could see his face. He looked like a mean boy fixing to smash puppies with a brick. "What is it you'd like to say for your own part?" he asked. Mrs. Underdown was shooting worried looks over at her husband like, "Oh, Lordy, what next?" "Nathan, there may not be a transition," Mr. Underdown said nervously, saying Father's name the way you'd say a growling dog's name to calm it down. "The miners have declined their contract on our advice. It may be years before this mission resumes." Father stared at the trees, giving no indication he'd heard his poor frightened wife or any of this news. Father would sooner watch us all perish one by one than listen to anybody but himself. Years before they send someone else to this mission, I thought. Years. Oh, please, God, make a tree fall on him and smash his skull. Let us leave right now. Mrs. Underdown pitched in helpfully. We are making preparations to leave ourselves. Oh, yes, her husband said, absolutely. We are packing to leave. We have called the Congo our home for many years, as you know, but the situation is very extreme. Nathan, perhaps you don't understand how serious this is. In all likelihood, the embassy will evacuate from Leopoldville. I believe I understand perfectly well, Father said, turning around suddenly to face them. In his khakis and rolled-up white shirt sleeves, he looked like a working man, but he raised up one hand above his head the way he does in church to pronounce the benediction. Only God knows when our relief may arrive, but God does know, and in his benevolent service, we will stay. Ada. So much depends on a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater standing beside the white chickens. That is one whole poem written by a doctor named William C. Williams. Chickens, white, beside standing water, rain, with glazed wheelbarrow, red on, depends much. So? I particularly like the name William C. Williams. He wrote the poem while he was waiting for a child to die. I should like to be a doctor poet, I think, if I happen to survive to adulthood. I never much imagined myself as a woman grown anyway, and nowadays especially it seems a waste of imagination. But if I were a doctor poet, I would spend all day with people who could not run past me, and then I would go home and write whatever I liked about their insides. We are all waiting now to see what will happen next. Waiting for a child to die is not an occasion for writing a poem here in Kalanga. It isn't a long enough wait. Every day, nearly one more funeral. Pascal doesn't come anymore to play because his older brother died and Pascal is needed at home. Mama Mwanza, without a leg to stand on, lost her two smallest ones. It used to astonish us that everyone here has so many children, 6 or 8 or 9, but now suddenly it seems no one has enough. They wrap up the little bodies in layers of cloth like a large goat cheese and set it out in front of the house under a funeral arch woven from palm fronds and the howling sweet scent of frangipani flowers. All the mothers come walking on their knees. They shriek and wail a long, high song with quivering, soft palates like babies dying of hunger. Their tears run down and they stretch their hands out toward the dead child, but never do they reach it. When they have finished trying, the men carry the body in a hammock slung between sticks. The women follow, still wailing and reaching out. Down the road past our house they go into the forest. Our father forbids us to watch. He doesn't seem to mind the corpses so much as the souls unsaved. In the grand tally up yonder, each one counts as a point against him. According to my Baptist Sunday school teachers, a child is denied entrance to heaven merely for being born in the Congo rather than, say, North Georgia, where she could attend church regularly. This was the sticking point in my own little lame march to salvation. Admission to heaven is gained by the luck of the draw. At age 5, I raised my good left hand in Sunday school and used a month's ration of words to point out this problem to Miss Betty Nagy. Getting born within earshot of a preacher, I reasoned, is entirely up to chance. Would our Lord be such a hit-or-miss kind of Savior as that? Would he really condemn some children to eternal suffering just for the accident of a heathen birth and reward others for a privilege they did nothing to earn? I waited for Leah and the other pupils to seize on this very obvious point of argument and jump in with their overflowing brace of words. To my dismay, they did not. Not even my own twin, who ought to know about unearned privilege. This was before Leah and I were gifted. I was still dumb Ada, slowpoke poison oak running joke Ada, subject to frequent thimble whacks on the head. Miss Betty sent me to the corner for the rest of the hour to pray for my own soul while kneeling on grains of uncooked rice. When I finally got up with sharp grains embedded in my knees, I found, to my surprise, that I no longer believed in God. The other children still did, apparently. As I limped back to my place, they turned their eyes away from my stippled sinner's knees. How could they not even question their state of grace? I lacked their confidence, alas. I had spent more time than the average child pondering unfortunate accidents of birth. From that day, I stopped parroting the words of O God, God's love, and began to cant in my own backward tongue, evil's dog, dog ho. Now I have found a language even more cynical than my own. In Kalanga, the word Nzolo is used in 3 different ways at least. It means most dearly beloved, or it is a thick yellow grub highly prized for fish bait, Or it is a type of tiny potato that turns up in the market now and then, always sold in bunches that clump along the roots like knots on a string. And so we sing at the top of our lungs in church, Tata Nzolo. To whom are we calling? I think it must be the God of small potatoes. That other dearly beloved who resides in North Georgia does not seem to be paying much